bribes from the government the other day. How open and credit and burn that. Man, the way that I live, don't concern that. Man, we gon' have to settle this another way. A letter from the government the other day. How open and credit and burn that. Man, the way that I live, don't concern.
Welcome to another edition of Critical Insights on Your World News. I'm your host, Solomon Kamajan.
And I'm your co-host, Tim Baldoff-Lenchen.
And today we're joined by researcher and historian John Judge. And it's a pleasure to have John on this episode of Critical Insight. John, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
No problem. John, I'd like to start off, you tell our audience, just want to hit the ground running, if you could tell them more about one of the organizations that you're affiliated with, the Coalition on Political Assassinations, and also the upcoming conference that you hold in Dallas, Texas. It's an annual conference. If you could tell folks more about that and more about the scope of research that you cover on a day-to-day basis.
The Coalition on Political Assassinations was started out as a coalition of groups and researchers into the Kennedy and other assassinations in 1994. And it followed passage, but not implementation, of the JFK Records Act. So part of the reason that we formed a coalition was to put pressure on the, by then, Clinton administration, because Bush had left, to appoint a board, an assassination review board, and start the release of the records that the act demanded. And we served as a watchdog and also an advisory group to that board to locate the records and to get them loose. And they ended their tenure after 4 years with about 4.5 million pages loose. We've got over 6.5 million pages loose now. It's the second largest release of classified documents in American government history. The only thing that topped it was a Nazi War Crimes Record Act with a similar panel of people looking at the documents instead of the agencies, and they've got over 8 million pages loose. And when I worked for Representative Cynthia McKinney in Congress, we drafted several times and tried to introduce a bill that was a Martin Luther King Records Act to get the files on Martin Luther King's life and death out as well, and we're still pushing that in Congress. And also gathered together because we wanted to pull the best research and make it public at these conferences that we held annually, first in D.C., and then we've done regional meetings in Dallas as well since 1994. And we're always out on the grassy knoll. We'll be there this Thanksgiving Day, because it falls on the 22nd of November when Kennedy was killed at 12:30, and we do a moment of silence and we speak. Next year, they're trying to deny our permit for the grassy knoll, and we're trying to negotiate with city officials so that we can do our moment, because it's happened actually since 1964, started by Penn Jones, and I've carried it on after he died, and it's happened every year, and this coming year, they're trying to block it. They want to freeze history at 12:29 p.m. on November 22nd, 63. When Nellie Connally, the governor's wife, turns to John Kennedy in the back of the limousine following his ride through the streets of Dallas where people were out cheering, and she says, "Well, Jack, you can't say Dallas doesn't love you." In the next 30 seconds, the shots ring out, and you know, he's hit in the head and killed right there. But they don't want to go to that place, because then that transforms Dallas into the city of hate instead of the city of love. So this is a PR exercise on their part to get rid of anybody talking about conspiracy theory, and they want to celebrate the life and legacy of John F. Kennedy in a dignified manner. And I argue that that's what we do every year. We just think his life and legacy got him killed, and that you can't talk about that at any other time than when he was killed. So. As a backup, I have called for an Occupy the Grassy Knoll next year in 2013, but hopefully we can get some cooperation from the city and the Sixth Floor Museum to let our event happen. This year, we're also having a conference from the 22nd that day with the moment of silence through the 25th in Dallas at the Hotel Lawrence, and we'll be having 10 speakers on different topics, and we're also trying to get 10 points of agreement about political assassinations, so that we will have a document going into the 50th that's a consensus of the research, serious research community. about political assassinations and what needs to be done as well.
Thank you, John. I'd like to ask you what got you into studying and researching political assassinations to the extent that you do?
I grew up in Falls Church, Virginia, which was the bedroom community of the Pentagon, the NSA, the CIA, the DIA, the NRO, and others you probably haven't heard the initials of. I knew from a fairly early age, my parents were civilian employees at the Pentagon. I grew up going in and out of the Pentagon as a kid. And I heard conversations at parties and neighbors talking shop when I was a kid that convinced me that there were two governments operating in the United States, one that you saw and one that you didn't. You know, I was affected by the assassination of John F. Kennedy. I was in a Catholic high school when it happened. I put up a matted picture of him. You know, people were in shock. I think anybody from that era probably remembers it with the same amount of shock as people in your generation remember 9/11. We knew where we were, and I could see, even though I wasn't very politically sophisticated at 15, I could see that the movie was reversing itself. It had been headed in a positive direction and toward detente and toward going into space and other achievements, and it suddenly reversed and we sank into the Vietnam War, the rise of the military-industrial complex that Eisenhower warned about. What really got me into looking at the assassination itself, because I had been doing more work on Vietnam, and I came out against the war in Vietnam in 1965 at my school and tried to influence people in that direction and held vigils. It was in about 67, I think, I read Mark Lane's book, Rush to Judgment, about the Kennedy case, and I thought, well, if half of what this guy says is true, we need to look at the evidence. And just by chance, probably because it was a Catholic college, University of Dayton, they had a full set of the Warren Commission documents. There were only, 7,500 sets. It wasn't too many. I mean, you know, and they were rare, but I used to hide in the library at night, and I read through the entire 26 volumes, compared them to the report, and realized that the report was not based on the evidence that they had released, even, and that they were lying. And, you know, it had tremendous implications if Oswald was not a loner who shot the president in a random situation, but it was a conspiracy to kill the president. Where did it come from? Once I realized that the bullets went two different directions, and I talked to early researchers at the time, Penn Jones and Mae Russell and others, I then realized, you know, that it was more important to follow Oswald and who Oswald was and who moved him, who set him up as a patsy, and what was around him. And if you take that trail, you're going to find a road back into the depths of military intelligence and CIA, FBI, quite Russians, and even elements of the old Nazi regime that were transferred here into the United States. I then, you know, lived through in 68, you know, the rise of Bobby Kennedy as a candidate who wanted to carry out his brother's plans, because the reason they killed Kennedy, he was pulling out of Vietnam. He was getting the troops out and ending the war. He was trying to reach detente with the Soviet Union. He had refused to go to nuclear war during the Cuban Missile Crisis. Curtis LeMay, the head of the Joint Chiefs, stormed out of the meeting saying, "We got to get rid of those sons of bitches," meaning the Kennedy brothers. And you know, he had started to he did a talk in June of 63 at American University that we go out and commemorate every year, where he called for an end to the arms race and an end to the Cold War and the beginning of stop nuclear testing and beginning of nuclear disarmament. He was reaching out in back channels to normalize relations with Cuba. He had blocked the assassination attempts against Castro and the raids against Castro. He was supporting international attempts at independence by various groups. He was upset about the CIA. He said he was going to scatter it to the four winds. He and his brother were threatening to end the oil tax depletion allowance, which was over $13 billion in tax write-offs for oil companies in those years that financed elections. He was pushing racial integration, too slow for the black community, but far too fast for the Southern Rim. And so a conglomeration of Texas oil men and other industrialists, because he had stood up to Wall Street and supported unions at different points and had not gone along with the corporate state either. Mafia, his brother, had been going after them. They were pulled in. Anticastro Cubans, who were mad at him for not bringing air cover in on the Bay of Pigs and attacking and blocking further raids to assassinate Castro. All these things had gotten him enemies, and the people that pulled the strings out of the Joint Chiefs of Staff for this military coup involved many of those groups and the CIA on the mechanical level, and then involved intelligence agencies and top people in the cover-up of the assassination afterwards. So by going into that and those histories, I then understood that these same forces were operating in 68 with the murder of Malcolm X in 65, or I'm sorry, 65 was the murder of Malcolm X, 68 with Martin Luther King, and also Robert Kennedy was being killed by the same group for the same reason, because he wanted to reopen his brother's case when he got in the White House. In terms of why they're important, it's because, and I even studied the Reagan shooting and other assassination attempts over time. It's not just that I'm looking at people that I like. It's because if you're going to have any semblance of democracy in this country, you can't have it aborted by political assassinations of political figures. And political assassinations not only impact on that level of an elected official, but also when they kill leadership in the black community, as they did to stop, as they called it, the rise of a black messiah, when they kill people for any political reason to hush a witness or to stop a writer or a journalist or a musician. If you go back and study the rise of the Nazis in the Weimar Republic, you will find that from 1928 till 1932, before they rose, there were a series of 400, the Weimar police admitted, political murders that they could not solve, they said. And those were the musicians, the academicians, the labor leaders, the radicals, were knocked out so that they wouldn't have a base to stand against the rise of the fascism when it came. And similarly here, hundreds of murders have followed from 63 on that have changed the political tenure and the ability to respond. The COINTELPRO program was specifically aimed and included assassinations at the peace movement, the civil rights movement, the militant African-American movements here, the American Indian movement, and movement since. It's still in place. They don't use the name, but they still have it in place. And actually the sons and daughters, I found out when I was in Congress, of the earlier COINTELPRO targets are still being targeted. One simple example is that the FBI approached one of Malcolm X's daughters, who was addicted to drugs at the time, and they had a white drug dealer who was also an FBI informant come in and give her drugs and befriend her and become a lover to her, and then had him plant the idea in her mind that she should take revenge on Louis Farrakhan for having been involved in killing her father. And we're trying to set up a situation where one of Malcolm X's kids would then retaliate against Farrakhan and the Muslims, whereas in reality these intelligence agencies and the FBI had manipulated both sides of that operation and were inside the Muslim circles, you know, and pushing the division and the hatred of Malcolm and pushing people to kill him. But the actual murderers of Malcolm X, two of the three, never went to jail. One's still living in New Jersey, were never properly identified. And then the whole structure relies on an ongoing lie after that point, where you have to keep covering up with more lies. Things begin to break, and then I found parallels. I found that the day after the Watergate break-in, five people named in a little article in the Daily News that I read, were names that were in the Warren Commission report. They had testified to the Warren Commission. They had been part of the Bay of Pigs operation and the Anticastro Cubans around the circles that helped to kill Kennedy, and people that were involved in the plot to kill Kennedy were arrested. And I called my mother, I remember, here in D.C., and I said, "Mom, if you see anything else about this arrest, I need you to clip it, because it's amazing to me that these people even got arrested." You know, but of course they were setting Nixon up to push him out and compromise the operation. But the showed up again in history, and I found that again and again in these assassinations, that there were teams. Bernard Barker said it had been 15 years since he had talked to Rodriguez and the other Cuban that were involved in the break-in at the Watergate, but it only took him 20 minutes to get in touch with them because they are standing armies that are kept on call by the intelligence agencies within these immigrant communities and other things. So it's a machinery that continues and continues unless you interrupt it and identify it and do something to stop it. It continues to have its potency throughout time, and it affects all of the political decisions, and it affects the foreign and national and domestic policy. So it's not just a matter of bemoaning a particular politician being killed. It's because this machinery of political assassination represents one of the major tools of repression of the state.
Right. Thank you. You've done a lot of research around the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King. Can you tell our viewers some of the key aspects regarding the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King, and who do you think was behind his assassination, why, and to what extent?
I think in all these cases, you had a patsy set up to take the blame for the killing. Oswald did not shoot John F. Kennedy. James Earl Ray did not shoot Martin Luther King. Sharon did not shoot Robert Kennedy, although he was in the pantry, but none of his bullets hit Kennedy, and the ones that were fatal to Kennedy came from a different direction. So they followed that pattern and did in this case as well. The other thing that was evident, and we got finally under FOIA and a court suit documents out about this, was that King was being surveilled. The surveillance of Dr. King's family actually started in World War I with his grandfather by U.S. Army intelligence. And Army intelligence played a major role in setting up the surveillance state. This Colonel Vandeman had files prior to the Palmer raids in the 1900s. And the beginning of the ouster of all the labor leaders and the radicals here, and the red raids, and he had files on millions and millions of people, and those files were then for Army intelligence, and then those were transferred over to Hoover and the FBI for the beginnings of the COINTELPRO operations. Even as late as the Frank Church hearings in the 70s. Fort Pachaca had files on 8 million Americans that military intelligence was spying on. I know they spied on me in the Subversive Activities Control Board because my mother was five levels above top security. I had military intelligence guys come out of my classes and tell me I shouldn't be doing the anti-war work, or tell me, you know, that they were spying on Carl Oglesby and SDS when I was in college. And you know, the military intelligence, not generally acknowledged, is more important than the CIA or the FBI. Are rarely talked about, although it controls 85% of the intelligence budget in this country. It employs 100 times as many people as FBI and CIA combined. Those are think tanks and you know, criminal operation things, but they don't do most of the dirty work. They go, if they want to assassinate somebody abroad, they go to the DIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency, and its arms, in order to do it. So in all of these cases, you have military intelligence involved. But we got documents that show that at the time of his death, Dr. King was under tight surveillance by FBI, a program called RIBAT, which was anti-communist because one of their informants convinced him he was working for the Chinese communists, and also under COINTELPRO. And then Operation MK Chaos by the CIA was spying on him, which was against domestic operations and black radicals and another isolating operation, you know, that went off in the CIA. And he was under tight surveillance that day and the days leading up to it by U.S. Army intelligence. And when I talk about tight intelligence, I'm talking about they're emptying his wastebaskets, they know his travel plans. And Hoover said at one point that if King wiggles his little toe, I know about it, because Hoover had informants in the inner circle of the SCLC to watch King and tell him what was going on and help to position him that day and put him in a vulnerable position. He normally stayed downstairs at the Lorraine. He was staying in a different hotel. The FBI arranged for a fake letter, supposedly from a member of the black community, in Memphis to complain about why he was in an integrated hotel, not staying in a black hotel. His people changed his hotel plans, took him to Lorraine. He normally stayed on the bottom floor when he could have come out the door right to the car. Instead, they put him up on the balcony where he had to walk a certain direction, you know, distance in one direction or the other, and made him vulnerable to be shot. And then also cleared out. At the time he was shot, no one was standing up there near him. One of them who came to get him for the dinner and pulled him out of the room and rushed him, Reverend Billy Kiles, I saw him on the 30th anniversary of the King assassination in Memphis outside the Lorraine, which is now the Civil Rights Museum. And he said, and this is what the video shows, he said, I used to wonder why I was there when Dr. King was killed, why God put me there. And he said, I was standing next to him like this, he put his fingers up. He said, and I moved down to the right so they could get a clear shot. Out of his mouth. I'm not making this up. Wow. There's videos of this. He moved down to the right so they could get a clear shot. And he said, and I asked God, why was I there? And God told me that I was there so he would die a clean death, not overdosed on drugs or stabbed to death in an alley. Well, you tell me what that means. Yeah. To me, that means somebody came to him and said, we'll kill him dirty if you don't help us kill him clean. And, you know, he's changed the story a little bit over the years, but that was what was out of his mouth on the 30th anniversary, standing up there with Jesse Jackson on the podium at the Civil Rights Museum. And, you know, there were people in his inner circle that compromised him and made those changes that day and chased the group out of there that might have been some security. Police security was called off at the firehouse and around him, and black Memphis police that normally guarded him that would have been reliable were pulled out of the situation at the last minute. We have other documents that show that Army snipers were on the roof of a railroad building down the, you know, at a distance, a water tower up there, but certainly within shooting distance, that had him in their sights. And these were Green Berets, and they were waiting for orders to kill King and a green light when someone else fires, not from the rooming house, but from the bushes across the street behind Kniep's amusement, and kills him. And the bullet lifts him up off his feet, according to the only other guy on the balcony, Joseph Lowy, a filmmaker who said he was there to document it. He'd been doing documentaries in Africa. It turns out he was CIA. But he was up there and saw him shot, and he said the body lifted up off the balcony and spun to his right. Well, if the shot's coming off to his right from above, it's going to knock him down, not up, and it's going to turn him to his left. So his physical reaction of his body is completely the opposite of what would have happened in the rooming house. The rooming house window photographed later that day is only open a little tiny slit. I went in that bathroom in 1971 and walked up there and saw how it was positioned. And there's a tub against two walls. The back wall has a window above the tub. The tub is flush with both walls, so you couldn't do anything out the window without standing in the tub first, which puts you at a higher level than the floor. So unless you had the top of the window down, you wouldn't have a clear shot. If you bent over and tried to get the gun out the tiny little slit of the window open about half a foot, it wouldn't help you because from where that is, the angle of the gun to point at Dr. King to the right would not allow you to shoot unless you poked a hole with your elbow into the wall and gave yourself some room. If you leaned out the window, which you couldn't do through the slit anyway, you wouldn't have any purchase, you wouldn't have any way to aim the gun that was reliable, and you wouldn't have a good shot. So that's not where the shot comes from, and not where the witnesses, even the people pointing in the iconic photo, where they're on the balcony, and his aides are pointing to where the shot came from. If you look at the angle of that balcony and see where they're pointing, they're not pointing at the rooming house, they're pointing dead across the street. Erskine Caldwell, the driver, and another guy that was down there, Cornbread Carter, said that, Caldwell was the lawyer and Carter was the driver. They said that the shot came, they were standing below him talking to him up on the balcony. The shot zinged by their right ear, so that's the wrong side for the rooming house as well. Carter said when he ducked, and then when he got up, he saw a guy get up in the bushes with a gun and go to the back of Jim's grill and hand the gun off. And that's the evidence we have now. And there was eventually a civil trial. The Memphis courts didn't give him any kind of a trial. They gave him a mini hearing and pled him guilty, and convicted him without the evidence. His appeals got up to the Sixth Circuit, but they were blocked as well. They, I believe, murdered two of the judges to stop his appeals. Judge Battle, his first trial judge, who had the right under Tennessee law to reverse it, dies with the Ray's case open on his desk of a heart attack. And another heart attack happens to Judge Miller, who was the stair-step integration judge in the Sixth Circuit, and the judge that put Jimmy Hoffa in jail. And he dies in the middle of the appeal. And then I saw a 3-0 in which, because he asked good questions at the hearing, and I thought it was the one that voted to remand it. And then when it came back from the remand, I thought he would vote in Ray's favor again, even if he was in the minority. It said it was a 3-0 decision. And so I called the clerk in Cincinnati and asked for a copy of the court slip. And it's got the three names there voting against Ray, and it's got an asterisk on Judge Miller's name. And you go to the bottom page, and the asterisk says, judge's opinion recorded posthumously. Well, that's interesting. Sit the dead man up and raise his arm.
Right.
The other two judges decided what he would have said. But he dies strangely, and nobody calls an ambulance in this special meeting that they're having with the judges. And there were witnesses that died, I believe, the murder of his mother in the church, and also the strange drowning in the backyard, fully dressed, of A.D. King, the brother, was because they were witnesses to the body and the wounds. We don't have good evidence about the wound direction because Dr. Francesco, the medical examiner in Memphis, decided that he didn't need to trace the bullet or he didn't want to do an autopsy out of respect for the family. And so he never cuts King, he never takes the photos, he never shows where the bullet came from. And the House Select Committee said, we can't determine the direction, exact direction of the bullet, but we know Ray did it. Well, that's ridiculous. But Dr. Francesco was also called, interestingly enough. That was in April. And in June, he was called by the Los Angeles Police Department to come to Los Angeles and to do the autopsy on Robert F. Kennedy. That's what I call, if it ain't broke, you don't fix it. They've got somebody in their pocket. And, the evidence was marred. I mean, we even got photos out recently taken by a Life reporter who never released photos until just, I think, 2 years ago that show Lorraine Bailey died that day of a heart attack. She was so shocked at what happened. She made the decision to move his room. She felt responsible. And the husband is up on the balcony in this photo that evening, wiping the blood off. There's no crime scene tape. There's nothing. So there's no forensics being done, even at the scene, to preserve it or to try to figure out what happened, because they don't want you to know what happened. But they had professional killers, and they moved them in. And if they didn't work out, they had a backup of Army intelligence behind them up on this top. So when you go into who does these things, you're usually going to find military intelligence on the mechanical level and often on the planning level, because these were, in their terms, national security issues. The rise of a black messiah, the effective leadership of the black community, the addressing of racism in the society, the peace movement, the American Indian movement, and other ethnic movements for liberation. These were national security threats, and so those are dealt with, and still to this day being dealt with and talked about at the Pentagon and the Joint Chiefs and the DIA, not just FBI. And FBI was taken over by Naval Intelligence at the end of World War II. Carthage Deke Deloach and William Sullivan from Naval Intelligence came and told Hoover they would protect his turf from the emerging CIA. And he let them form Domestic Operation Division 5, which ran COINTELPRO.
Thank you, John. I'd like to ask if you could give us your thoughts on the U.S. military industrial complex and its impact, especially considering peace in the rest of the world.
Well, I think that what Eisenhower in his first draft warned about was a military industrial intelligence complex, and that's what we live under. Penn Jones, one of the earliest researchers, used to say in his Texas drawl, He said, "We have been in the death grip of the military-industrial complex since November 22, 1963. And he paused for a second. He'd say, "Now let's all pray I'm wrong." But I don't think he was wrong. I think we have been, and I think we've been in a permanent war economy, which is what happens in the last stages of monopoly capital. Because you have to expand markets and you have to grab resources, so you go into permanent war. Permanent war also gives you a fake economy that's dependent on producing weapons, and you know, it's not job efficient, but you know, and then you fill your coffers from the gains that you get out of the war, and you also use it as a way to go to become extra constitutional. You know, even the early founders, Madison, the others, knew the war was the worst enemy of democracy, that it aggrandized the power of the executive, it opened up the congressional purse, it allowed all sorts of excesses, and it curbed dissent. And, you know, Goebbels said that it's not hard to have a war. All you have to do is scare the populist and, you know, and demonize the pacifists and the anti-war people. And, you know, you can march the country into war. Well, I mean, we've lived under first the Cold War lie and all that propaganda that we were in danger from communist takeover. Then they went to about the 1980s, terrorism and counterterrorism as the motif. And that's basically what we're existing in now. But when you have somebody like Cheney after 9/11 saying we're going to go in as many as 60 countries, and a war that won't end in your lifetime, you better listen up. It doesn't mean you have to put up with it, but you better understand that these guys plan ahead. My mother planned draft call, accurate within 100 people either way, the annual call for the draft, 5 years in advance. Wow. And you had tables from the Joint Chiefs of how many people would die, attrition levels, death levels if they were at war, how many retire, how many re-up, how many enlist anew, how many discharge under each category, therefore how many did you have to draft. Even the draft figure that she came up with, the accurate one, had to be multiplied by 5 because the Selective Service System would flunk 50 to 55% at a physical, 10 to 15% would get a deferment or exemption, another 10 to 15% wouldn't show, and then they were back to the 20% they needed. So they even built in the resistance in their planning, and they were planning 5 years ahead that accurately. And she told me, when I asked her after she retired, when did they tell you they would escalate the war in Vietnam? She said that in April of 63, under Kennedy's orders, she changed her projections for the first time in a 30-year career. She was ordered to change her projections in Vietnam and to project a full withdrawal of all American troops by the end of 1964. And I said, "Well, when did they reverse that? When did they start to escalate?" She said, "Late November." I said, "The last week in November." Something happens on November 22nd, yeah. Friday. She said, "Yes, the Monday following the assassination." So this is Kennedy barely in the grave. My mother comes into work, and the Joint Chiefs and the Planning and Direction Office have projected for wars tell her to project a 10-year war with 57,000 American dead. She couldn't believe the figures. She went back up to the Joint Chiefs. She'd never done that before, and she said, "These can't be right." And they said, "No, those are the figures, and you'll use them." And they know where they're going. We don't, but they know. They know how long it will take and what it will cost in human terms and also in money terms. And they run the purse and they determine the direction of the society. And they've spent $8 trillion since 9/11, which was at worst a black eye. It was a terrible incident, but it hardly brought the country to its knees or put us under a war situation. They've spent $8 trillion on defense increases, intelligence increases, and homeland security. And they plan to spend much more. Right. Why do you have an economy, you have trouble in the economy in this country? I wanted to get a bumper sticker. It's the Pentagon, stupid. You know, you can't spend this kind of money. And plus, it's to no result. Because they will you can't build a society that's impervious to every possible attack. You'll go broke and you'll go crazy. And you can't bomb everybody and kill everybody, even though they'd like to, most of them. But if you're not going to go back and address why there is asymmetrical warfare and terrorism, as they call it, coming out of these societies. If you're not going to ever address that, then you're just going to escalate it. And even Rumsfeld admitted that they didn't know whether they were creating more enemies than they were killing. Well, that's right. You are creating more enemies. If you just meet violence with violence, that's what you get. There were attacks in France in the last decade from the sons and daughters of the Algerian freedom fighters who had been slaughtered by the French military years before with brutal methods. And so you just create a generational black hole of violence that's going to perpetuate itself. And unless you're going to restore justice and restore hope in these societies that have gotten so desperate and they see no end, that they're going to sanction and support violence to get their way out of it because they don't see any other option. If you give them another option, then that's going to undermine that route. But if you do tit for tat, like Israel, Palestine, that situation, it just keeps going. And you don't need to spend trillions of dollars to do those things. You can with a small fraction of what we spend every minute, you could make a lot of the world comfortable and feed them and clothe them and take care of their justice needs. And you know, but that's not what it's about. It's about a small group of people at the top, supported by and protected by this military-industrial complex, who are hoarding the surplus of the world and hoarding the resources of the world and monopolizing access to them, to the point that almost all of us now are disenfranchised in that model, and they don't care whether we survive or not. We have to care about it. So to me, part of the reason that I did all this work on the political assassinations was that they were commonly known events. I wasn't coming into the room talking about some arcane subject. I was coming in talking to almost everybody remembered where they were and what they were told by the government about the incident. And if I could use facts and historical research to get them to realize that they were being lied to and to look at things in another way, then there's a chance always that if you throw a monkey wrench into the matrix of false assumptions of people, that they can enlighten themselves and wake up. And so it's a kind of Western Zen that I try to do with the assassination research. But it's, I think it's as important to understand the mechanics in the Reagan shooting and who went after him as it is to understand who killed Kennedy.
Right. Thank you. And since you brought up, the topic of war and the trillions and trillions of dollars that have been spent on war, post 9/11, can you tell our viewers your thoughts on Libya, Syria, and beyond? What is the U.S.'s end game in that region? And especially since you're the woman that you previously worked for, Cynthia McKinney. She went on the ground in Libya just a year ago, and she's written a book, and she took a delegation there. The work that she did has basically been shunned and suppressed by every mainstream outlet in the U.S. But can you give us your thoughts on Syria and Libya and what is the U.S.'s endgame in that region of the world? What are they trying to do?
Well, I think you can go back to the 1950s and Richard Bissell and the CIA under the Eisenhower administration drew up plans for the whole continent of Africa. And the plans there and across the globe, I believe, especially in smaller countries and countries that have any amount of independence, is a plan of destabilization. And if you don't understand that, then it doesn't make much sense to you. What are they doing? Why are they doing this? Why are they creating these conflicts and these messes and all this death? But if you understand that destabilization on many levels allows you then to manipulate the outcome and the economy and otherwise. Naomi Klein has a book, Shock Doctrine.
Right.
And that's what they're doing. They're creating the shock, however they do it, through through interventions or civil wars, but they don't allow the situation to be stable economically or politically. And then they penetrate the situation and eventually force now not even a colonial or a neocolonial model, but what's called a neoliberal model on countries by having the banks come in and take over the infrastructure and put them in debt and then determine their economic reality. After they do that, they don't really care who's elected into office because they can't change their conditions, much in the same way that we're trapped Wall Street here in terms of what we're able to change. And, I think that that's the overall plan. In terms of the specifics, what I see is that they've gone into Afghanistan and Tajikistan and all these countries to surround one of the largest oil deposits in the world in the Caspian Basin in the former Soviet Union. Also, there are tremendous resources in Russia and cheap labor. And eventually, I think they want to tap that. It's well-trained and educated labor, but it's very cheap. And also, they're in general not needing labor in the modern technology because they've technologized and robotized so much of extraction and other things. But they have, especially since they got satellites up, they have world maps of where key resources are. And they can determine, you know, where there's deposits of different rare earth materials or minerals or oil or gold or whatever it is they want. They know where those things are. And they have geopolitical strategies to keep their hands on them where they can and to compromise the situations around them. So a lot of this also is not even because we want the oil. About 4% of American oil comes from the Middle East. It's because we don't want Japan and Germany, who have no internal oil source, and it's one of the reasons they lost World War II, to get their hands on cheap oil. And by monopolizing the movement of oil out of the Caspian Basin by pipeline to the Gulf and putting it on a tanker, the tanker can then go out to sea and take bids, and the highest bid gets it. It artificially inflates the price of the oil, and it keeps those countries in check. Because if you think about it, from World War II forward, what the Nazis did was they switched over and became our allies against the Bolsheviks and the Russians and the Soviet Union. And they got us to buy into the Cold War mythos that the real enemy was then communism and worse than fascism. So we brought hundreds of Nazi spies and Nazi scientists and technology people over to the United States to create the CIA and the military-industrial complex in the Southern Rim and the technology that went into outer space and to create the Cold War, which was the Dulles brothers who were in cahoots with the Nazis and made deals with them before the end of the war when it was clear that Hitler was not going to be able to go in as they had positioned him to do. All the industrialists around the world and the monarchs put up the funds to rearm Germany to go in and knock out the Bolshevik rule. And when he was stopped at tremendous human cost at Stalingrad, then they had to change plans. But the Nazis also changed plans and retreated and began the Cold War. And what the Cold War did was to gut the economy of their two former enemies. The Soviet Union fought them and the United States fought them at the same time and were allies. So they went back into one of the allies, pitted them against each other, much in the same way as COINTELPRO would pit two groups against each other, and then ruined them economically, gutted them economically until by the 70s, Japan, a little island, and Germany, not a very big country, were capitalist competitors on the world market with the United States and the USSR, who had diminished themselves by building this huge nuclear and other warfare capability and wrecked their infrastructure and economies doing that. But we have control of oil in part so that they can't sort of cheaply rise again or compete with us as effectively. That's part of it. But it's also geopolitical containment of areas, just like Vietnam was fought primarily to contain China. But if you want to figure out war, get an atlas. Go see what's there. If you want to know why we're in Afghanistan, read its history. 95% of the world opium comes out of Afghanistan. That's worth more than gold. It's worth more than guns. That's worth protecting. And similarly, you know, there's going to be oil deposits or other kinds of riches. They also know that south of the mineral and other resources of Africa could keep the United States at its current consumption levels for about, and they want to make sure that they have control over that So it's a grab for water, it's a grab for oil, it's a grab for resources, and for geopolitical control. But that grab is also pushed by, objectively, a need for genocide, both here and abroad, to reduce the population and to put the matter into the hands of fewer and fewer people.
Thank you, John. I'd like to ask you how the military adversely affects African Americans and what type of incarceration rate we see in military prisons among African Americans.
Well, it's traditional that people of color are overrepresented in the wars, especially wars abroad, that the United States has taken part in. During the draft period, because people think, oh, the draft would be more fair. I don't support either a poverty draft or a paper draft. I don't think there should be any kind of force, and I think that the military should be democratic and take care of people and let them get out if they don't like it. But I think, you know, without those rights, you have a poverty draft in place. But even when the paper draft was in place, 55% of the people drafted were African American.
Wow.
Under the poverty draft, it only got up to 36% of the force. And that's the economy pushing it. So the draft was more systematically racist. Everyone who goes in the military takes a test called the ASVAB, the Armed Services Vocational Aptitude Battery. And this test has been looked at by civilians, and it's race and gender biased. So it roots all people of color and women into the dead end, slow promotion, combat, and the worst jobs in the military. And it does that systematically. In addition to that, there's no rise in the numbers of people of color or women of any substantial degree in the officer corps. So while they go up in the enlisted ranks and doing the dirty work, they don't go up in the officer corps levels. And, you know, they're not represented there. They're overrepresented on the front lines for the most part. African-American enlistment dropped by half since the beginning of the Iraq War, so they're only about 18% of the force. The recruitment is focused on Hispanic communities. They're also going after people of color in other countries. They're telling illegal immigrants here that they can get their citizenship if they join. They're proposing this DREAM Act where you get a citizenship for somebody born here if they'll join the military. You know, the military has become the right of passage to citizenship. They're even going into Africa and other Latin America areas and telling people you can become a U.S. citizen. People aren't even asking to if you join the military and fight these dirty wars for us. So, just on the basic level, this means that people of color in this country are constantly being pitted against people of color in another country. It's like Jay Gould said, Baron, industrialist in the 1900s, I can have hire one half of the ruling class to kill the other half. And so they're hiring one half of the people of color to kill the other half, basically. When they get in the military, there's a lot of systematic racism in the military. Yes, there's racism everywhere, but you can't get back out the door in the military. You don't have effective ways to challenge the racism in the military. You can't organize. You're not allowed to have a union. You can't even pass around a piece of paper without getting busted in the military if they don't give you permission. You can't talk back to the boss. You have to follow every order that you are given. So there's no way to fight the racism that you're experiencing once you're in. And in addition to that, if you're African-American, you face the last industrialized nation in the world that has a military, internal military judicial system, military courts, and military prisons. They have a 98% conviction rate, and you're four times as likely to be court-martialed if you're black than if you're white in the military. So the military prison population, in general, is 60% black, and the death row population, because they do have capital crime as well under military law, is 80% black.
Jeez.
Wow.
And so, you know, there's that, and then you're much more likely, one out of eight overall get a less than honorable discharge in the military. You're much more likely if you're black, it's one out of three. And so African-American males leaving the military right now are four times as unemployed, four times as homeless as veterans that don't go in. But in general, veterans are three times as unemployed. And it's not really any place you learn a skill. It doesn't guarantee that you'll get college money at the end. If you get a less than honorable, you don't get any bonuses. But even if you get a college bonus, it doesn't get enough money to get you through a regular college all 4 years. So you're ending up having to pay it. yourself anyway, and you're putting yourself at risk for 8 years, stop loss up to 9.5 years, and they can keep calling you and do multiple tours all the way to the end of your period, and you know, even if you survive physically, many aren't surviving mentally,
right.
And they have the highest suicide rates they've ever had in the military. They have, you know, tremendous. Even women are committing suicide at higher rates, and they have a tremendously corrosive situation. And people, about a third of the people coming back with these stress problems. I don't call it PTSD; I call it post-genocide syndrome, and it has to do with what they're being asked to do because modern war is genocidal by its nature. In World War I, the number of people that died that were civilians and not troops was 4%. They fought in trenches and no man's land. By World War II, they had longer range weapons. They fought in cities. The civilian death level went to 25%. By Korea, it climbed to 56% because they were using counterinsurgency warfare, killing civilians as part of it. From Vietnam forward, the number of civilians that die in modern war is 94 to 96%. Completely the reverse of World War I. And that, to me, makes modern warfare effectively genocide. It's not troops that are dying. And they're trying to keep troops off the field. They want to roboticize it. But modern war is also ecocide. It's the most destructive thing to the environment. Vietnam was the rice-growing capital of the world. They destroyed so much of its arable land and broke down the pine barriers between fresh and salt water that they had to import 95% of their rice afterwards. And they're still trying to recover in terms of usable arable land. And, you know, things are still toxifying from World War II, toxifying fisheries and things like that. So the most toxic places on Earth environmentally are military bases. So it's ecocide, it destroys the environment, and it's ethnocide. It destroys cultures and moves and displaces people, destroys the ties that people have within their ethnic cultures, and forces them into the monoculture. And I don't think that humanity can survive war, modern war. I think either we've got to stop it, and we've got to change this militarized society, we've got to dismantle this military-industrial intelligence complex, or the planet itself is not going to survive.
Thank you. So, great segue to my next question. You know, in terms of what you just said, in terms of stopping it, you do a lot of work with an organization that I believe that you founded called Choices, and that's counter-military recruitment in Washington, D.C., the schools, and you go around, you know, and you know, do counter-military recruitment. So my question to you is, can you talk to us about the work you do with Choices, you know, what's it about? And also, the other part of that question is to ask you, have you been met with any kind of resistance within the D.C. school board based around, you know, the work that you do with Choices?
Well, yes. I have resistance both on the school level at times, and especially from the JROTC instructors, and also with the system itself. But Choices is part of a national network of people that do counter-recruitment. I began bringing veterans into high schools to talk to young people in 1968, coming back from Vietnam, because I thought young people needed to hear what they were saying and understand the reality of that war. And I did probably, as far as I know, the first training counter-recruitment in New York in the 70s when I worked for the Central Committee for Conscientious Objectors. And familiarize people with the methods that they were using to recruit people and how the recruitment worked, what was legal, what was not, and also ideas on how to counter it and how to get accurate information about what was happening to people when they enlist. So I've been doing this work, you know, for many, many decades, working with other people, but there is a national network opposed to militarization of youth that you can find online that has good materials and a lot of information, and there are local places around the country that are doing this, and it should be being done in every community. If you consider yourself anti-war, you should consider seriously working on counter-recruitment. Not because we're going to stop everybody from going into the military, but because young people at least can make an informed choice and know that they have other options and help to put a different light on things and demilitarize the society to some extent. I mean, I also did GI support, GI counseling, so it wasn't like because somebody decided to go in the military, that was the end of the discussion with me, and it isn't. And the same with returning veterans. I still do work to support them, and I held a conference up in Cambridge recently with Paula Kaplan, where we had about 25 groups that do non-stigmatizing and non-drug-oriented treatment of war combat stress in a lot of different creative ways. And that's a Better Welcome Home online. You can find out about those alternatives, because if you go in and they say you have PTSD, if they're willing to say it, you don't want the drugs that you're going to get that they claim cure it. I mean, the drugs themselves are toxic and they don't help you. There are healthy and good alternatives for veterans coming back with combat stress out there, and I try to work on that as well. But Choices has relied on a rule since 1980 in the D.C. schools that if they have JROTC or they have Junior Reserve Officer Training Corps, or misnomer, doesn't lead to being an officer. But it's a way to militarize the kids and to make it more likely to enlist. If they have that, or they let recruiters into the schools, then they have to let in a counter-recruit, another point of view. So we've pushed our way into the doors of D.C. schools, both public and now charter schools, since 85, with certain levels of resistance. We don't get into every school we want to get into. Some have ROTC instructors that have got us kicked out, and we're battling with them. Sometimes just the schools themselves say, well, we don't have recruiters in here. All our kids are going to college. We don't need you, but they actually do, because when I ask the kids, how are you going to college, they tell me they're joining the Air Force. We should be in all the schools, and we should be in the curriculum, to tell you the truth, to talk about war and peace and these things. But we at least get in on career days and to some senior class visits or senior assemblies in most of the schools in D.C. around the year. And we bring veterans in, we bring military family members in, we talk about the realities that I just discussed with you, and we talk to them then also about alternatives, where they can get money for college, where they can get job training, placement help, apprenticeships, and other programs in D.C. that can help them before they have to feel that the military is the only choice they've got, and to make sure they know it's not the best choice. It's a lot of promise, but it's not a lot of fulfillment on the promise, it's hype. What you're going to get out of the military. And for some kids, it seems to solve a problem. We had a young kid at Spring Garden State that talked to Jared Ball, who went in with me one time. He's a Navy vet. And he asked the kid, why do you want to join the Navy? And the kid, I've been shot 3 times already in my neighborhood, and I think the Navy's a safer place. There's some logic to that. Except that now, for the first time even since World War II, people in the Navy and the Air Force can be dragged into the Army if they need frontline troops. And they've been desperate enough to do that. So just joining the Navy doesn't mean you won't be in the Army nowadays. So you have to show people the way for them to get out of their situation. Otherwise, just telling them that the military's a bad choice when it looks like the only choice is just depressing them. So we try to do both and really give people an option. We've been fighting the school board. We did get them to put into the enrollment form the language that says that if you don't want your child's identity and contact information given to recruiters on request, you can check this box, and that has both the student and the parent can sign it, or either one. That's in every enrollment form. A lot of the parents don't know what it means and they don't sign it, but if they do, it prevents the recruiters from getting easy access. They have other ways. They have a database of purchase records of teens that they use to get contact information. But if they get hold of it from the high school and you don't prevent them, they're very aggressive here in D.C. They'll call you over and over and over 30, 40 times, and they'll come to the door with the ASVAB test and try to use it to convince the parent that you're good in electronics and you scored well on this, you'll do great in the military. They use it, and it is one of their major recruiting tools. So we did get D.C. to stop using the ASVAB test. At least we think we did, because it's very hard to get any information out of D.C. And we've seen some figures that at least the charter schools were still using it. But the D.C. public schools at least told us that, that they weren't using it. We have not had much luck in getting rid of JROTC, even though in the 80s, when D.C. was under receivership and run by a financial control board, we got a citywide decision from the school board and from the city council to get rid of JROTC in all the D.C. schools. We got that voted in, but In the meantime, the Financial Control Board had appointed a group of generals to run the schools as trustees. Eventually, someone challenged it in court and it was thrown out. But for a period of time, the head of the D.C. schools was this guy, General Lucius Becton. And at his first public appearance, I handed out a sheet about who he is, because he was the guy, along with Colin Powell, who covered up the My Lai massacre. Then he came out of the military, and because he said it would be bad for morale. He came out of the military, and he went into Kissinger's Food as a Weapon program for a period, and worked on that. Then he went into FEMA, Federal Emergency Management Agency, and he was in there in the mid-'80s and late-'80s, when they had the Military Law exercises, the Rex 84, Rex 85. That was during his period, so they were cooperating with the DOD and the National Security Council of going to continuity of government and martial law and having exercises about it that he participated in. Then he became some kind of a educator, or at least a dean at some college in Texas, and they brought him in. And he brought in other military officers then to run the D.C. schools, and the officer that he brought in to do educational programming in the D.C. schools, his previous job had been the warden of the top security military prison in the United States. I said, well, that may have something to do with where you want these kids to go after high school, but doesn't have much to do with educating.
Right.
But the quality of what we had, and they took this democratic decision by the elected school board and the elected city council and ignored it. And I heard him recently interviewed on Kojanamdi, and he just laughs about it. He said, oh, these people didn't want Jay Rossi. You know, but they illegally, in my view, stopped that Democratic decision. We haven't been able to build steam since then to get Jay Rotzi out. Now they're leaving it to each school, so we're trying to use the school advisory boards for each high school to see if we can get them to dump it. And we think it'd be much better for free to have Habitat for Humanity in. It teaches kids an actual skill. It teaches them discipline and teamwork instead of marching around with a rifle stick. And following orders and yes or no, sir, and it benefits the community. It does something concrete for the community of building houses for poor people. I mean, that's just one option, but I mean, they could have many. But that certainly would be better than only military thing that, you know, talks to you. And you're 50% of the kids that go into even 1 year of JROTC enlist. That's way higher than kids outside of JROTC. So, you know, they're basically suckers for the system. But for a period of years, up till just 2 years ago, every high school in D.C. went back to forcing the freshman class. It used to be all 4 years before 1980, forcing the freshman class to take JROTC. They signed everybody up into it, and it was mandatory.
Wow.
High school principal told me, oh, it's not mandatory, it's just required. I said, well, how do you get out? He said, but yeah, you can get out. I said,
it's not. It's just required.
Where's that now for me? He said, oh, well, they have to be a member of a peace church, like a Quaker. That's World War I.
Wow.
Why can't they just say that they don't want to take JROTC? And recently, I got in touch through Catholic Workers with this young girl at Roosevelt High School. And even though the core curriculum came in and they stopped making everybody take it, they're targeting certain kids and telling them they think it'd be a good idea if they took JROTC. Probably because they think it teaches them discipline. It doesn't teach you discipline, it teaches you obedience. You can teach a dog obedience. Self-discipline comes from somewhere. But they took this young girl who was a refugee from El Salvador and had been in a war zone and didn't want anything to do with war in the military, and they forced her to take JROTC, and she complained. And she said that early on in the class, the instructor came in and he handed out a blank piece of paper. And he said, now, if anybody is in here who doesn't want to take this class, you just need to write down a reason why you don't want to take the class, but it's got to be a good reason. So she wrote down that she was from a war zone, she'd seen war, she didn't want to be in the military, she didn't want to wear a uniform, didn't want anything to do with it. He picked it up and he said, that's not a good reason. So she went to the principal. The principal told her, if you quit JROTC, you're going to lose credit for every other class you're taking in the freshman year. And I went to the guy who I was told was like in charge of the schools, like in, you know, day-to-day operations, and I talked to him about it. And I talked, and he went and talked to the principal. And then he yelled at me and said, why did I go over the principal's head? I should have talked to the principal. I said, the principal already told her something outrageous, in my view, that she was going to lose all credit if she quit one class. You know. And I said, what point would it have been for me to talk to the principal? I said, besides that, I don't want it just to be a decision of Roosevelt and the principal about that one kid. I want the whole school system to stop doing this. And that's what you are. But, you know, we had a meeting one time that we arranged after, well, I don't know if you know about D.C. schools, but the elected school board became a half-elected, half-appointed school board. And then on top of that, the mayor appointed a chancellor of the schools, Ree, who came in with the Duncan that's in now, that privatized everything, wrecking the school system, firing teachers and everything.
Yeah.
During her administration, we tried to get in, and we talked to this woman under her, Susan Ellery, who was in charge of the programming. And we brought a group in from Choices. We brought a lawyer in. We brought vets in. We brought, you know, I came in. Pat Elder came in as another counter-recruiter. We even got a woman from the ACLU because they had just put out a report that says that the methods they use in recruiting children violate the child recruitment protocols of international law that we've signed up on. So, you know, we got in there, and we're on one side of the room, and the other side of the room, there's all these other people, not just her. And we're just a community group trying to meet with this woman, but she brings in the lead attorney for the D.C. school system, another D.C. school administrator, some guy from her staff, an older black man that supports Jay Rotsey. And then she brings in two people from the Pentagon. She brings in the woman, the head of all lab testing in the United States, and the guy that's the head of the chief of all Army recruiting in the United States. Well, this is to a meeting with Choices in the D.C. school system. Do you think that maybe means that D.C. is a little bit important, that they're maybe testing some things out? Because I think they had that mandatory program here first to see if they could export it and work around the country. And I also think that it was for fraud, because you have to have voluntary enrollment in Jay Rotsey at these schools of at least either 10% of the class or 100 people in each school. And if you don't have that, you don't qualify for the federal funding. And I think their enrollment got down so low they didn't qualify for the funding and they had to get rid of the program, so they artificially beefed it up by making every freshman take it in every school. But we can't get the D.C. school system, under FOIA even, to release the enrollment figures for those years and to see what the change was and where it got down to. So, you know, they block us at every point from getting real information, and then when we show up to actually talk to them, they bring in these people to counter us from the top levels. So we're doing something, you know. But you don't understand from outside that system how important it is to address it, you know. I think, sadly, that, you know, and I saw this at the end of the draft, we could get, when they thought the draft was going to come back, we could get a whole room full of people over at the Quaker House who were upset that the draft was coming back. But when we went to a training session on counter-recruitment in the poverty draft, we get hardly anybody. And what that tells me is that the poverty draft also relieves the white middle class and upper class from any anxiety, because they know that the poor and the black and the Hispanic are going to be the ones that fight the wars, and they're fine with that. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, John. For people that are watching this right now or maybe at a later point in time, how can they get in contact with you and support the work that you're doing?
Well, the Coalition on Political Assassinations has a website. It's politicalassassinations.com. And Choices does not have a website, but anyone can write to me, John Judge. It's about like a judge in a courtroom, JOHNJUDGE, at starpower.net if they're interested. We just put out a calendar by email of the schools we're getting into, and if they want to join us and go there, they can. We're trying to see if we can arrange a. We had a community forum about counter recruitment the other day. Over St. Stephen's, and we're trying to see if we can get more people involved and do a training session for some new people. So if you are interested in helping with that, just write to me at johnjudge@starpower.net. Another long-term project that I'm involved in that includes all of the work that I'm doing in terms of what it will reveal is a museum of hidden history. And it's going to have stuff in it about the assassinations, about the research work I've done on 9/11, about the military and these issues, about all different aspects of hidden history from different gender and racial and ethnic perspectives, and just in terms of history that we're not allowed to see by the national security state. And there's a website for that, museumofhiddenhistory.org. And so those are ways that you can plug in. National Network Opposed to Militarization of Youth, I think, is NNOMY, its initials, .org. And there's also a Center on Conscience and War here in D.C., which is centeronconscience.org, which does counter-recruitment work and works with people in the military. So that's a start on how to plug in, but there's lots of stuff up on the internet that can help people do.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot, John, and appreciate your time today, and most importantly, we appreciate the work that you've been doing for so many years, and will continue to do. And we look forward to having you on Critical Insight on Your World News sometime in the near future.
Okay.
Thank you. No problem. That's John Judge. I'm Solomon Kamajan. This is Tim Bowdoff Lynching. You've been watching Critical Insight on Your World News, where peace is not an alternative. It is not an option. It is a mandatory. As you said before, it's a requirement. It's mandatory and it's a requirement. But at Your World News, we're also a place where we believe that journalism and activism are not mutually exclusive. Thank you so much, John. Appreciate it.
All right. Thank you, Sean.
I got a letter from the government the other day. I opened and read it and burned.